The views expressed on the Final Straw Radio do not necessarily reflect those of Asheville FM, Friends of Community Radio, or any of the affiliate radio stations airing the show.
You're listening to WSFM LP 103.3 in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw. I'm William Goodenough.
And I'm Bursa Goodness.
The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWA LP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRS LP in Columbus, Ohio.
This program is brought to you by Firestorm Books and Coffee, located at 610 Haywood Road. Firestorm Books and Coffee is a worker-owned cooperative in Asheville specializing in offbeat, underground, and independent literature. Firestorm's full catalog of books and zines can be found online at firestorm.coop.
The show will later be archived at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can email us with questions or suggestions at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. If you care to, you can send us letters at The Final Straw, care of Asheville FM, 864 Haywood Road, Asheville, North Carolina, 28806. This is the first half of The Final Straw Radio's second conversation with Paul Z. Simons, co-editor of Modern Slavery magazine and anarchist who chronicled his trip to the Rojava revolutionary region in northern Syria. The writings show up under the name El Errante. In the upcoming 55 minutes, we'll talk about feminism and gender in Rojava as Paul experienced it, some of the development of institutions in Rojava, martyr culture in the Rojava context, and more. Sean Swain is having a very hard time right now and could really use to be reminded that he is not alone. If you haven't written to Sean in a while or haven't heard back from him due to the ODRC messing with his mail or cutting off his other methods of communication, now would be a great time to flood him with letters, cards, photos, drawings, books, zines, or anything. In particular, now would be a good moment to remind Sean that he matters to you, that you are glad he is alive, and that you see him as contributing to the world in a way that matters to you. Every once in a while, we all need a loving kick to the head to get us back on track and feeling ready to continue fighting. Now is that moment for Sean, so send him a kick. He deserves it. Write to Sean at Sean Swain, 243-205, Warren Correctional Institution, P.O. Box 120, Lebanon, Ohio, 45036.
And we are joined for a second conversation with Paul Z. Simons, one of the editors of Modern Slavery magazine and the author under the pseudonym El Errante. I assume that's the errant, like an errant knight sort of thing.
It's actually, there's a history to it. Would you like to go through it real quick?
Yeah, totally.
So Daruti and Escazo, you know, after they killed Calvo Sotelo, who is the Archbishop of Toledo, went on the lam. And part of their going on the lam was coming to Central and South America. And they were hired at a sugar plantation in Cuba for a month or two. And they had a really brutal foreman. And they got talking to the workers there. And they said, why don't you just kill this guy? And the workers were shocked. And so two or three days later, they found this guy shot to death in his chair with a note taped to him that basically that said, La Justicia de los Errantes, which is the justice of the wanderers. So I've always liked the term errante, or, you know, los errantes, the wanderers, because it's kind of open-ended, you know.
That's cool. I'd never heard that story before.
Yeah. No, they were... Yeah, it's one of my favorite stories of them where, you know, they were in their pistolero stage and nothing was basically going to stop them from they saw as justice.
Justice of the one.
Love those guys. Love those guys.
Oh, and I'm the type of guy who will never settle down. Where pretty girls are, well, you know that I'm around. I kiss them and I love them, cause to me they're all the same. I hug them and I squeeze them, they don't even know my name. Call me the wanderer, yeah, the wanderer. I roam around, 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 around. Oh, well, there's Flo on my left arm, and there's Mary on my right. And Janie is the girl, well, that I'll be with tonight. And when she asks me which one I love the best, I tear open my shirt and I show a rosy on my chest, cause I'm a wanderer.
So we were talking yesterday, and we covered a lot of subject matter. But okay, and I didn't finish this, but we're talking about Paul's recent trip to Rojava, the revolutionary area in northern Syria that is, yeah, going through a social revolution, ostensibly feminist, anti-capitalist, and ecological, influenced by Murray Bookchin, post-leftist, as you said in another interview. So I'm super fascinated to get to pick your brain about this more.
Sure.
So the background, Öcalan, Abdullah Öcalan was involved with and formulate to and like central to the and still continues to be the PKK, the Kurdish Workers Party based in Turkey. Right. And that, as you pointed to, which has been in an insurgency against the Turkish state for 30 years, and that it's had an influence and an effect on the PYD, which is one of the major political parties inside of Rojava. So can you talk about like connections and disconnections between the PKK and the PYD and other elements of this democratic and federalism movement within Rojava, and also like how is this philosophy that Öcalan is big into, like with the democratic and federalism, does that seem to be the framework that Tevdem is operating from, or is it slightly different, or could you tell?
Sure. Well, going back to the PYD and PKK, now, you know, the minute I crossed the border and they knew that, I was carrying journalist credentials, and they kind of sat me down and they read me. It was kind of two things that I think every journalist got when they came across the border, which was one, the PYD and the PKK are two completely separate, non-contiguous things. So don't worry about that. And I think that the reason for that was that I've said in a previous interview is because PKK is, you know, recognized by a number of different security agencies as being a terrorist organization, including the U.S. State Department, you know, I think European Union, that type of thing. So when he's telling me this, I'm kind of like, you know, the terrorist stuff doesn't bother me at all. You know, it's what I'm thinking to myself. But, you know, I'm listening to what you have to say. And then the other one is that what you're experiencing here, what you will experience as you go through Rojava, is part and parcel of the thought of Abdullah Öcalan. And kind of the secondary question was, did you know anything about it? And I said, well, everything in English that I can get my hands on, I actually have read, which I saw him kind of like, you know, going through like, wow, that's really interesting, because I'd never heard that before from a journalist look. So I think he was real pleased that he was talking to somebody who had a little bit of background knowledge and had done their homework on it. So, you know, with Öcalan, just to kind of back up a little bit, now PKK starts out as Marxist-Leninist, and obviously the Marxist-Leninists lost the Cold War, and I think he got looking around for – he was arrested and convicted of terrorism in Turkey and then sentenced to death. And then that sentence was commuted a little bit later on because Turkey has been angling to get into the European Union, and one of the, you know, hoops that you have to jump through for the European Union is that you don't torture your prisoners and you don't kill them. So that's one of the reasons why, you know, like the United States will never be part of the European Union, because we get to torture our suspects and we get to kill them. So he was, you know, his sentence was changed to life imprisonment. And in prison, his regime became a lot more liberal in the mid 2000s, and he was able to read and think, and he came up with, you know, he was reading Bookchin, and I think the book, if I was going to say Bookchin's book that really affected him, would probably be Post-Scarcity Anarchism. You know, Foucault, some of the other post-structuralists, that type of thing. You know, he seems like a pretty smart guy, and did a pretty good amount of reading, and came up with this concept of democratic confederalism. And if people are really interested in it, there's a book. It's free on the internet, downloadable PDF format, and it's, you know, his discussion of democratic confederalism, and it's very interesting. It's real general. There's no real specifics to it, but you can kind of see how it relates to what's going on the ground in Rojava, which was one of my questions that I wanted to answer. It's like, so I have this general document about kind of a new society, and then I've got a new society in blossom. How do the two relate to each other? So that's going to be one of the I'll probably write a, I mean, in the process of writing a book about it. And that's one of the questions that I want to address is how reflective of his ideas is the society that's currently coming about. And if I was going to put it in three words, it's like more reflective than you would imagine, you know, more reflective than you would think. But it's a longer question than we really have time for. So BYD then came into being kind of underground in northern Syria in Rojava before this sea change at the ideological level of PKK, and that was around 2002-2003. At the same point in time, a lot of the structures that they had been playing with in southern Turkey were transferred to northern Syria as well, including the YPG, the militia structure. And so these were obviously very underground organizations. They were not, you know, above ground at all. They were not, you know, they would have secret meetings in the middle of the night. I mean, the whole conspiratorial deal. The big difference, and I think this is key, and I may have touched on it in a previous conversation, is the fact that these weren't new militants who were coming into North Syria. These were, you know, hardened guys who'd been working within the PKK for years and really knew how to organize and how to put together structures that were innovative as well as secretive. So that, I think, is real key in terms of lessons for us in terms of training stuff. It's like, wow, if we're, you know, we've got to learn if we're going to do something, you know, similar to this, or if we're going to look at what's happening there, it's like the ability to be able to erect structures and also, you know, really malleable structures too. I mean, in some instances, they've had to collapse pieces of the PYD and pieces of the YPG as a result of repression. So, and organization has always been of interest to me. So this may be a lesson for future generations, you know, so. And then obviously with 2011, 2012, kind of the magical happened and they found themselves suddenly in control of a relatively significant swath of northern Syria. In other words, there was no sovereign power. The Kurds were relatively well armed. And I was asked, where did the arms come from previously? And there are two answers to that. One is some of the arms are obviously being smuggled across the border from Turkey. And the other one is that a lot of the arms are old weapons that have been taken from the Syrian army or Syrian army dumps that were in the area. That said, and just to go back, these are not large weapons. These are Kalashnikovs, old Kalashnikovs, the old Warsaw Pact Kalashnikovs, as well as Deshko guns, which are – it's more like a rocket-propelled grenade type of weapon. It's more a recoilless rifle type of weapon than it really is artillery. It's larger ordnance, but it's a big-ass rifle for all intents and purposes. So that's pretty much what they've had.
What's the name of those rifles?
Believe it or not, they're called Deshko, right? It's like, you know, and it's a Russian weapon, I guess, prevalent in the 50s and 60s, and then sold eventually to Assad in the 70s and 80s. So these are not new weapons, but there's, as with the Kalashnikovs, there's a lot of them and there's a lot of ammunition. You know, I mean, the Kalashnikov, the Warsaw Pact Kalashnikov, you know, you talk to people who have done purchases of them, and they're nowadays they're sold by the pound as opposed to by the individual unit. I mean, that's how many there are of them.
That's crazy. These are, yeah. So looking online, like 12.7 millimeter heavy machine gun, the kind of thing that you would see like mounted on the back of a truck in a war zone frequently, right?
Correct. You know, and when you see the YPG thing, you know, they've got the steel shields around them and they're mobile. You know, they kind of the battlefields are so fluid, and, you know, when they're fighting on open ground, which they don't like to do because they'd much rather fight within villages or within cities, when they're fighting on open ground, it's kind of hard because they sit so high. And Daesh, which has had better access to weapons through seizure of Iraqi arms depots, as well, basically American arms depots in Iraq, and the arms depots around Damascus and Aleppo are much better armed than the YPG. So that's one of the reasons why the consistent refrain from the YPG is don't send us advisors, send us weapons. Because it's, you know, if you've got people with artillery and mortar and things like that, as well as tanks. I mean, there were, you'll see in some of the pictures that were put up on the Modern Slavery website, there are old Russian tanks that were, you know, disabled by the YPG. And that was, they were disabled by homemade grenades. These were literally guys going up and tossing a few sticks of dynamite or plastique into the tank treads and then blowing the tank up and forcing it to stop and then killing the tank crew inside. So, you don't see any, you know, you don't see any armor piercing weapons on these tanks at all. It was all basically destroying their motive force. So anyway, so, you know, it was kind of for the PYD, it was kind of a perfect storm of everything happening at once. They had structures on the ground that were, oh, I said it on the ground first one. They had structures there that were available to them, that were malleable, that were very well, the level of permeation within the community is kind of hard for us to understand. And I'll give an example from the translator that I worked with, Mohammed. I've described him before, and I'll probably describe him again because he was just a wonderful guy. But I'll preface it by saying this guy and his family were not revolutionaries by any stretch. They did not wear khakis. They did not have pictures of Ocalan on the wall. They did not have, you know, YPG and YPJ flags in their home at all. They, and the men dressed Western. The woman wore a his mom wore a loose scarf. So not real, you know, pretty secular as well. And when he was, his name, Muhammad is the name that he was given in Syria, because the name that he was given by his Kurdish parents was Ajit, A-G-I-T, and that's the name of the guy who fired the first shot in 1984 that initiated PKK's war in Turkey.
Whoa.
So that's his real name, and he still doesn't use it, but that's his real name. And the first year he went to school, he kept that name through the first year and literally fought it out on the schoolyard every day with Syrian kids because they knew exactly what it meant, you know. So that's an example of how deeply the resistance culture and the revolution permeates just into a normal home. Like I said, this is not – I sat in homes of revolutionaries. I sat in homes that had, you know, YPG and YPJ flags and pictures of Ocalan and his writings and things like that all over the place and played revolutionary music, the whole deal.
By that, you sort of mean like partisans, I guess, right?
I would say individuals who are deeply engaged in the revolution. I hate to use the term because it calls to mind communism, but I would say cadre, basically individuals who are members of Tev Dem, members of PYD, maybe children who are in the YPG, YPJ. I mean, individuals who are deeply engaged in the revolution, which is not, you know, that's not where Mohammed's family was from. You know, Mohammed's dad dug wells and supported the revolution, but was no revolutionary. But his very first son, he names after this very famous revolutionary who also happens to be a martyr, you know, because he was eventually killed, I think, in 86 or 87. So, and this naming people after, you know, heroes and martyrs is huge. It ties into one of my posts, and I can actually do a follow-up now. So I did a post on a graveyard in Kobani, where individuals who were killed during the June 25th massacre, when Daesh came in and started slaughtering civilians, the 233. And I mentioned the fact I finally get a chance to see one of the gravestones. Nujin Gever, who is, I believe, a little girl who died at the age of 9 months at the hands of Daesh. So I'm looking through, literally last night, one of the magazines that I brought back from Rojava. And as I'm looking through it, I can't help but notice that there is a young woman named Nujin Gever who died about 2 months before that baby was born.
Huh. What did you find out?
My guess is that baby was named after that martyr.
So can we, let's talk about this for a minute, like I've sure. About martyr culture. And actually this is something that Rydra asked me to ask you. So within like, I think I have like kind of a basic understanding of it. I grew up Roman Catholic. I did a lot of really nerdy study about the IRA and about struggles in Ireland, Roman Catholics mostly. And there's a lot of like in the continuation culture of that, like A, there's sainthood and, you know, in the church aspect of it and a remembrance of the dead and reverence for people's acts. And so there's also martyrs for those who weren't beatified. Many of those martyrs became saints. Like that's a part of sanctification in the Catholic Church. And within within IRA subculture, which was very, especially with the provisionals, was very family-based in the North, as I understand it. People, and revolved around churches and the pubs and whatever else, they had to incorporate it into all these different elements of people's lives. And it's amazing what I know of it, and I have never been directly connected with it. But I remember going into a bar in San Francisco in like 2003, maybe. And but they also, when I went in there in like 2003, I saw these cards in a display of like in like the stairwell that were martyr. They were martyr cards from Ireland of people who had died in the service of the Republican cause. Recent people during the 70s and 80s and 90s. Which is not unlike if you go to someone's funeral, oftentimes there will be, in a Catholic church, there will be these cards that are handed out with a picture of the person and a saint on the back and like a story about the saint and a story about like a short obituary about the person and a prayer.
Sure.
Like, can you, what sure. what is the martyr culture as far as you're aware, and how does it tie into political organizing within the Kurdish communities?
Well, first of all, we should probably stop for a moment and recognize that this is being recorded on November 11th. And that in 1887, the Haymarket martyrs were hung in the Chicago General Jail today.
Wow, so that's a good point.
As long as talking martyr culture, let's recognize the fact that we do have martyrs in our culture, and that today is what has been a significant day in anarchist history and culture. So, a moment of silence. There we go. Moment of silence. All right, there we got it. Okay.
That's I didn't even think of that. That's so good on you.
So, you know, a couple of things actually, and I think that, you know, relating it actually to Haymarket to begin with is a real good place to start, because Haymarket, the martyrs there did the martyrology that followed from their deaths produced a lot of new recruits and a lot of new blood for the anarchist movement. And I'll just as one example, Emma Goldman is drawn to the anarchist milieu by virtue of the fact that she had read about the martyrs. And those martyrs, you know, we know that they had cards, very similar martyr cards drawn up, that posters were made and spread about. And in the Chicago milieu, unfortunately, as the working class there began being sucked into the liberal trade unions, more and more of their work was remembrances of, you know, Spies and Parsons and the other martyrs and things like that. So it's a piece of our culture, but it's in Kurdish culture, from my understanding, there, first of all, I'll say that, you know, we associate martyrs with like a handful of individuals. So Haymarket being the classic example, Daruti and Escazo being other examples, you know, Sacco and Vanzetti, you know, probably maybe the most famous anarchist martyrs. But in the mindset of the PKK, and this, by the way, is not, this is less northern Syria than it is Turkey. This is something that has been going on, you know, decades prior to the Rojavan experiment. You get the sense that there's no specific, you know, there's just a handful of martyrs that people look up to and things like that. There are hundreds. Well, actually, there are thousands of martyrs. And you'll see in one of the pictures that I think it's in the first or the second dispatch of a rather large sign, which has maybe a picture of 100 faces of different young men and young women who died in the fight for Rojava. And I think probably Kobani, but I'm not sure because it was taken in Jazeera Canton. So there's a resonance there in terms of not only this struggle for autonomy by the Kurds, which began in 1984, but any Kurd who knows their history, which is a lot of them, will tell you that this is like the 80th time that the Kurdish community has risen to try to establish some level of autonomy for their ethnic group. So it links into that somehow and deeply. And one of the best ways to show that is children are still named either Nur el-Din or Salah ad-Din. And Salah ad-Din was, of course, the Islamic anti-crusader who basically brought the Frankish knights to their knees and cleaned out Jerusalem and that type of thing. And he was a Kurd. And so there is a sense of, you know, Kurds, military, you know, throwing individuals out who oppress us, that type of thing, which runs kind of like an underground, you know, resonance through Kurdish culture. The only other time I've ever experienced it has been in Vietnam, where I did a lot of work in Hanoi. And virtually any time you talk about culture or history in a Vietnamese context, you get stories about resistance to the Chinese or resistance to the French or resistance to some other invader. You know, they don't really have, you know, different story. I mean, their stories are all about freeing Vietnam from an oppressor, somebody who's occupying their land, that type of thing. So obviously when we're talking about Kurds, where they really have never had any control over any of their land whatsoever, that translates directly into almost a pure sense of resistance. And that plays out for me when I hear that my translator, you know, is named after one of these first guerrillas, you know, who was involved with the PKK. It plays out in a number of different ways. Some of the revolutionary institutions, like I talk about, there's an Institute for the Family of Martyrs, which is meant to act as a kind of a support group and a help for families that have lost loved ones in the fighting. And when you walk through that building in Kobane, they have pictures of the individuals who died and whose family members attend meetings and that type of thing there. The ceremony with the transfer of the 18 bodies, the 18 heroes from Kobane to Jezira Canton is another example of kind of a ritual. And it was a very unritualized ritual. It was very kind of like handing over the death and the burial certificates. I took a drive out to, went out to the martyrs cemetery with folks, and a martyr cemetery is set off from the other cemeteries. They have their own kind of martyrs, a little monument there for the martyrs, and they're building actually a larger one. And these graves are very well kept. It's a tended graveyard, and it is guarded. There are guards at this graveyard on occasion, you know, carrying Kalashnikov. So they guard the bodies of the dead martyrs. I'd also say that martyr, when you're speaking Arabic, martyr relates back kind of to an Islamic thing. Martyr in Kurmanji relates more to hero or dead hero. So the sense of dying for a cause is still there, but the sense of heroism that goes along with it, in other words, it's not being cut down in the midst of one's life or, you know, throwing gas over yourself in a square or something like that, or being hung. The martyr is someone who fights back and dies fighting. So that's a piece of it as well. And then the final take on it is, I was talking to this, my contact in Kobane, in Tevdem, Mr. Shaif, or in Kurmanji, Mr. Shaiko. And we were talking about it a little bit, and I said, so what's the, you know, what really do you see the martyrology, you know, this whole kind of cult or, you know, institution of the martyrs, what does it do? And he says, you know, there's a lot of things that it touches in Kurdish culture, which you would need to stay here for years to understand. But for us right now, for every martyr, 30 people will join the YPG or the YPJ.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And I said, well, that's enough. Thank you. So that's kind of an overview of it. And, but, you know, I was looking at a magazine last night, and virtually every magazine, regardless of whether it's sports, volleyball, that type of thing, will have either the front or the back cover or the inside cover will be pictures of martyrs. And these are not necessarily, you know, revolutionary magazines or magazines produced, you know, by Tevdem or by the YPG, but just regular old, you know, Kurdish magazines about, you know, their sports love is volleyball, something like that. But nonetheless, martyrs will appear on all those. So
it's like enough. It's enough embedded in the popular culture and so present that there's no need for any institution to like imply or like push them to publish the pictures of the martyrs. Like it would be kind of insulting if they didn't, sort of thing.
I think it's a partial way to maybe have people, you know, A, identify with the martyrs, but B, to move. I mean, when you identify with the revolution, whether you're a volleyball magazine or whether you're a YPG magazine, people are willing to pick you up and read you, maybe even buy you. Right.
Yeah.
As a magazine. So I think that there's a certain, I mean, you know, the Kurds are crazy like a fox. There's a certain marketing thing that goes along with it as well as a buy-in into the culture and a buy-in into the revolution. In other words, this magazine supports the revolution to the extent that we'll publish pictures of martyrs.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So returning then back to Muhammad a little bit, one of our last conversations, as I said, well, so are you ever going to take, you know, your name back, Ajit? Are you ever going to change it? And evidently he had talked about it with his family, and they had decided that after the revolution was won that he would take back his name.
So they're hopeful.
They are.
Or assured.
They got more hope. One Kurd has more hope than you'll find in an entire city in the U.S. You know, I mean, they really, that was the one thing, obviously, that I walk out of there with. You only need to read one or two of my articles to figure out that it's, you know, that was one of the more stunning pieces of my experience there, is that there is no fear. There's complete understanding that they're surrounded by really terrible, horrible, huge enemies, and yet there is a sense of this is where the world begins, and we're going to do it, and this is what we've got. I mean, the sense of hope there is just overpowering. It's like, I don't know, it's like the dust in Kobani that gets kicked up from the street. You just can't avoid it. You know, it gets in your eyes, it gets in your nose, and pretty soon you're breathing it, and you're okay with that. You know, it's weird. I'm sorry I waxed poetic.
Oh, no, please. It's great. And this is another thing that you talked a bit about in the other interview, the Free Radical Radio conversation, which I really liked. But and in your writings, just walking away with the sense of hope and having the sense of hope. And
I guess it buys for me a lot of things, I think. And I think the first thing that I get out of it is the fact that, you know, for 250 years, our argument, the anarchist argument, has been it's workable. It is a good idea for a society. It is not scary, and people will be able to benefit greatly as a result of existing in an anarchist society. And over and over and over again, from liberal to Marxist to even some anarchists, it has always been stated, well, it's a wonderful blueprint, but it could never work. And, you know, regardless of our ability to point out small pieces of, you know, victories here and there, there have always been sufficient enemies to be able to snuff those experiments out rather rapidly. You know, we can't point to anything more than maybe a month or two when really, and I mean, Spain would be a great example, but Spain, they never relinquished, they never, you know, eliminated the nation state. The nation state was always there. So it can't really function as an example of an anarchist society. Now we have one. And one that appears to be working quite well, and one that that people are buying into, and that appears to be an effective defensive unit, an effective political unit, and people are happy. You know, I mean, in the midst of all the things that are going on around them, people are happy. And, you know, for me, that's, I never thought I'd see it. And second, like I said on the interview with Free Radical Radio, I always had a feeling that if I was ever in a revolution, that this mentation and this cogitation that goes along with being identified with the post-left anarchist would leave me immediately, and I would be dragged forward into it by the heart and or the balls or the ovaries. And that is exactly what happened. It is ultimately, for me, a revolution is a change. It's a change of heart. And part of that change of heart implies the implantation of that most dangerous quantity, hope.
Waxing poetic. I don't think you can help it.
Apologize. I didn't say on the ground at all.
No, you didn't. You didn't. And I won't count that reference on you either.
Fair enough. No, it doesn't count because I was using it as a negative example.
Yeah, exactly.
So that, you know, and sometimes a milieu needs something like that to pull it forward a little bit. Sometimes we need a kick in the ass from our hearts to be able to push us into the next projects. And I feel like for me, at least, Rojava has been able to provide that. you know, not that what we're doing here in the U.S. is necessarily terrible or not doing anything. I think some of the experimentation here is really fantastic. And some of the ideas that are coming out here are, you know, phenomenal, top-notch, probably better than anything coming out of anarchist thinkers in the rest of the world. But that said, it, to me at least, it settled into basically a debating society, you know, at least with post-left anarchism. And I would very much like to see myself and my comrades take that dangerous step into realpolitik and try to understand what's going on, even if it's a three or 4,000 miles away in a culture that's very difficult for us to understand. If for no other reason, that I think it'll make us better critics and better theorists, and at heart, better people and better anarchists.
And I guess, like, if some echo of anarchism or something that at least rhymes with it or is related exists somewhere, that's like that feels like the kind of thing that an anarchist would maybe be interested in contributing to or experiencing. Like, you write about the idea of stepping onto soil that's not contained within a nation state, and that's a very, I've heard people quote that a few times as a very like fun, like just a phenomenon that none of us really considered possible in our lifetimes.
Right. And neither did I. I mean, it's always been a dream of mine. I mean, you can pull essays of mine from the late 80s where I basically talk about walking on free ground and desiring that more than anything else. And I only wrote this in, a comment on A News, but, you know, that boat that took me across the Tigris from the regional government to the autonomous region, when I set my feet on the ground, I, like, took a picture of them. It's like, look, you know, feet on free ground, you know. And of course, you know, being the emotional, immature man that I am, I, you know, was literally choking back sobs. It was something, you know, out of a dream. And it was definitely amazing. So, and I will say, you know, we've talked about it a little bit before, I think, but for us, it is this huge going into this bubble where there is no nation state for the people in Rojava. At this, you know, having, it's basically the third year that this has been happening for them, it's almost banal. I don't know. Did I tell the story of Muhammad with his passport?
No, that was the other conversation. But if you want to, that'd be great.
Sure. Well, Muhammad, the translator that I worked with, had 2 years of college English under his belt when I met him. His school was destroyed in the airstrikes in Kobane. And so he had talked to me just the last couple of days as we were discussing stuff. And he had said that he would really like to finish his degree in English. And I said, well, that's a really good idea. And he says, what do you think about me coming to the U.S.? And I said, I'd sponsor you in a heartbeat. You know, if you can get over here and run through the hoops, you know, to get to the U.S., I would do everything in my power to be able to get him into a university and have him finish up those 2 years. Cause I think that's one of the things that as an anarchist I can do is to provide as many experts and technicians to this group, you know, to these folks as possible to help them out. And he said to me, well, the hardest part is actually getting a passport. And I said, well, how hard is it? And he says, well, for Syria, I would have to go all the way to Doha and Qatar to the Syrian embassy there to be able to get one. And I don't have the money. I would never be able to make that flight, let alone that I think $1,000 that I would need to be able to purchase a passport. And I said, what are the options? And he says, well, I can get one from the anti-government. And I said, anti-government, what do you mean? He says, well, you know, we don't have a state here, but I can still get a passport from the Rojavan, you know, the Rojavan government, even though it's not one. So they call it the anti-government. And, you know, I'll never forget, we're in like a hookah bar. I mean, in Kurdistan, those are kind of like places where men go at night and smoke hookahs and play cards and things like that. So we're kind of doing this over a hookah bar, very mundane setting, and a very mundane statement from his. It was almost like, you know, if you and I were sitting in a bar or a restaurant and said, wow, we just eliminated the government, you know, both of us, we would probably get up and dance around the tables, you know, throw a few lit napkins out onto the street, whatever it would take. But for him, it was just like, it's a done deal. You know, we've eliminated the state. We've got other things to do now that the state is gone. So it's the banality of the realization that they've produced a society, a democracy, what have you, without any state apparatus that is jarring to an anarchist who, you know, every morning you get up and you pray for revolution, you know, and then all of a sudden when it happens, it becomes, well, I had breakfast, we, you know, we don't have a state, and now I got to go and, you know, work for the Kobani Authority or whatever. So, it's really crazy. So that kind of gives a feel for how we kind of look at it. And I know that I hope that some of the discussion that people have about my writings is when I tackle it, because one of the issues is going to be, you know, can we really call it an anarchist society? And the best way to be able to do it at the political level is, you know, does sovereignty exist? And sovereignty, you know, is a real simple concept. And I would definitely go with the liberal definition, you know, produced at least as early as the French Revolution, probably earlier by Locke, which is that sovereignty is the monopoly of force contained within an individual or a single agency over a geographic area of ground, right? So, the United States, you know, is a nation state because they have the army and the police and that type of thing, and those are the only people authorized to be able to use force within the boundaries, the borders of the United States. In Kobani, in Rojava, that sovereignty is not implied at all. The federal government, the one source that should be in control of force, doesn't, and force flows from now three separate entities, which would be, well, four actually: YPG, YPJ, the ASEISH, which is the Internal Security Forces, and now the HPC, which is an even more devolved force of militia, you know, power devolved for form of militia, which is present in the bloc formations and the council communes and things like that. So, and again, I think that I'm sure that it is intentional. I know that from talking to the people who are involved in some of these institutions it's not chance. It's not an accident that there are multiple sources of power, both military as well as political power within the country, because the recognition is that the more they can shatter power and put it back into the communities, the greater the likelihood that the revolution will survive.
So in the other conversation that I'm going to keep pointing to that you had with Ryder, and also in some of your writings, you talk about like the devolution of power.
Sure.
And that idea that the devolution of like, and the dispersal in this kind of Foucauldian sense, I guess, of mm-hmm. power among the population more directly, like is one way that the revolution will be, be able to be perpetuated and keep an internal, an internal power from rising and concentrating all that power back. But I can think of, like, off the top of my head, it kind of makes me think of Tito's Yugoslavia or like Libya after their revolution with Gaddafi. They had a lot of popular militia ideas, right?
Right. And Cuba too. You know, the Cuba, the watch committees and that type of thing. Absolutely. Absolutely.
But I guess just because you can point to examples of when it didn't work well doesn't mean that it's not going to work well in this instance too.
And I think too that the control that was exercised over those local militias was controlled through a single party. And Tevdem, which is primarily responsible for what's going on with at least one of the militias, the HPC militia, has representatives of all the political parties as well as concerned individuals within it. So it's not like one single party is going to be preeminent. Are there a number of PYD activists within Tevdem? You bet. But do they function as a bloc, and do they control what Tevdem is doing? Not by any stretch.
Yeah, you even mentioned that there's like Muslim Brotherhood in there, and there's like Christian committees or councils that form and decide to participate with these things.
Correct. And there's an entire apparatus of women in Tevdem. And as a matter of fact, the Tevdem has implemented, primarily in a couple of the larger cities, kind of a watch and ward committee for women to make sure that they're not being physically abused by their husbands, and that they're protected on the streets at night if they're working in the evening, that type of thing. So there's kind of a women's militia that's coming into being as well.
That's kind of like in the way that the YPJ and YPG relate, that there's like a mixed HPC, and then there's it like just a women's version of it.
Correct. Okay. Correct. Correct. Yeah.
We haven't really touched on like the feminism and the anti-capitalism specifically too much in this conversation. Is there a way we can like wheedle those in and just if you want to share some experiences, conversations that you had or things that you witnessed, the conversation of like talking about the in the other conversation when you were talking about the Yazidi young Yazidi man that was coming had been serving in the militias and like his experience and going back home, that was pretty cool. But if you have any other stories too, I'd love to hear.
Sure. I had a really good press pass, a really good press pass. I don't know how I got it because I showed it to a number of other journalists. Like, how the f*** did you get that? It's like, I don't know. They gave it to me. So I had access to like all YPG areas, which is pretty unusual because those are usually considered secured. So, you know, Mishtinor, which is the hill above Kobani, I really wanted to go up and see because it's kind of one of the famous photos of the siege of Kobani is the flying of the YPG flag when they raised it over Mishtinor, basically indicating that, you know, the last major artillery control site that Daesh had was taken and was the city was effectively in YPG hands finally, you know. So I wanted to see it. I wanted to get up there and take a look. So we drove up I checked in with the YPG and made sure it was cool because I'd rather not be shot to death for, you know, being a trespasser, and got a pass as well, another pass to get up there. So we got up there and that was where I saw the first time these the militia outposts that they're currently in the process of building. And, you know, I mean, it's all standardized stuff. I mean, these are outposts that they're putting in everywhere throughout Rojava for YPG and YPJ units. And like I said in previous interviews, I mean, this is a men's barracks and a women's barracks that are joined by a mess hall, kitchen, meeting room type of thing. And so right now, if you're walking down a street in say Kobani, you will see a lot of men and a lot of children hanging out. Women have a tendency to hang out in the home, and young women who are going to school, you will see, you know, going to and from school, but they'll be together. So they'll be traveling in groups of, you know, four or five, that type of thing. You will never see a young woman out on the street alone in Kobani any time of day. Just not going to happen. Women who are married, scarves over the head, that type of thing. Yeah. You will see those occasionally. So that gives a sense of the segregation, as well as in every home that I visited in Kobani, there are two living rooms, one for men and one for women. Okay, so if you have friends over, you know, the men are going to sit in one room, the women are going to sit in the other room. You know, you both may be drinking tea and there may be some back and forth between the two, but it's, you know, if a man would enter the woman's room where they're all sitting, that would be considered really bad etiquette. For women to enter the men's room, actually that's kind of bad etiquette too, but it happens every once in a while to help with, you know, serving food and tea and that type of thing. So here you kind of have a reflection of that in these barracks. But then you have them eating together, which is pretty unusual. Men will eat with men, women will eat with women. And you also have them going on patrol together, relaxing together, playing volleyball together, things like that. I mean, it is such a fundamental violation of Middle East social space, particularly as defined by gender, that to see it is just to be floored by how radical it is. You know, and for us, it sounds like, wow, you know, it's nothing major. There, it's like a bomb set off, you know, in some type of church or whatever. It's unbelievably radical, just to begin with. I mean, there's something about it. As an example, too, and I think that this is the YPG and the YPJ, regardless of how effective they are as a fighting force, I think that they're also an incredible school for the revolution and school for the empowerment of women because of things like that. Because, you know, men and women are now interacting with each other, you know, at the level of talking and discussing what's going on and you know, working together and doing their soldierly duties or their militia duties together, that type of thing. But it also breaks down further into the duties within the barracks as well. And so I told the story about a Yazidi militia man that I spoke to, and the Yazidis had kind of avoided any type of contact with PYD or anything that was going on there. And then after the rescue of Shingar Mountain, they became involved more directly with what was happening in Rojava. And a number of young men, not young women yet, but young men have been taken into the YPG militia. In Yazidi culture, there is a real definition of men and women, not only in terms of social space, but in terms of duties and roles and responsibilities in the home. Yazidi men do not cook, period. There is no cooking by Yazidi men. It is all the responsibility of the women. And this young militia man, you know, who just, I think he'd been a militia in the militia for maybe 4 or 5 months when I spoke to him, had gone through the training 45 days and then had served another month, you know, to kind of finish out his training. And during that period in time, you know, the way that the cooking responsibilities go in these mixed kind of company units is men will cook one night and women will cook the other night. So, you know, for a lot of the Kurds and for the Arabs, they kind of get used to it. For the Yazidi, it's a fundamental violation of this cultural space thing. It's like, oh my God, I'm cutting potatoes. Oh my God, I'm frying up, you know, peppers, that type of thing. It's like, I, you know, it's so he did this and, you know, he was like, I realized how wrong this was, that my mom was responsible for feeding a house full of men. Evidently, he had a whole bunch of brothers, aunts, or uncles, and that type of thing. So he told me that he spent his first leave home, so this would be 4 days after, you know, about 2.5 months gone, doing nothing but apologizing to her and helping her cook in the kitchen. Right. So for us, a baby step in a Yazidi household, again, this is a sea change, the like of which, I mean, you know, is for Yazidis, thousands of years in the making. You know, I mean, Yazidism is earlier than Christ and maybe earlier than Judaism, you know, because it's based in Zoroastrianism. So these are cultural norms that have existed for 2,000 years plus.
And now it's going home.
What's that?
Now it's being brought into the home. Like, yeah, it's not
exactly. Just... And, you know, the brothers are witnessing this. The uncles are witnessing this and probably thinking, A, what the f***? And then B, oh, I get it. This is part of the revolution. You know, who knows? But so that kind of, you know, there are other institutional things that go along with it. And I'm not sure how closely they adhere or not, depending on the neighborhood and the commune. But the in theory, on paper, each one of the councils, when they meet, should at least have 40% women in attendance, which the council meetings that I went to, that was the case. There was 40%. Councils that are large enough will have a co-chair, which is a woman. And the only person in that council who will have veto power, which is basically the power to say, we're stopping the process right here. Nothing goes forward. You know, I'm veto. We're stopping this, is the female co-chair. So there is a sense of, you know, this is why I was arguing, I shouldn't do this, but I was arguing with this, some Marxist on this one website about, you know, the Kurdish proletariat and, you know, how they're trying to achieve gender parity. And my answer back was, they're not trying to achieve gender parity. They're basically trying to place a significant source of power in some ways more power within women's hands than within men's. And it's not necessarily to right old wrongs. It's because they recognize that in many cases, women can make better decisions than men, depending on what the decision is. You know, so there's a sense that they're really, you know, rigging a different system for so that women not only have a say, but have a powerful say. They're not just voices. They can stop stuff. They can make stuff go forward. So that... And just one, I haven't told this story yet, but I went to go see my friend at Tevdem, and I had gone there with a translator. And each the offices that you walk into in the Tevdem headquarters in Kobani have signs above them that basically say Arab affairs, Christian affairs, women's affairs, you know, and then Asayish and, you know, security issues, you know. So each one is like that. There's a Tevdem representative there and they're dealing with stuff. So when I walked in there, maybe 10 or 11 o'clock one morning, all the offices were empty with the exception of like the Tevdem representative who was responsible for the different affairs, with the exception of the women's room, which was packed with women. And I just, you know, I wanted to go in and ask a question. And so I kind of sent the translator Mohammed over. I'm like, Mohammed, like, ask what's going on. And he came back and he said, well, they're waiting for a meeting. They're doing a meeting on some dress issue that they're having, you know, with YPG or YPJ, something like that. And I said, do you know anything about it? He said, no, but, you know, these women are basically going to tell YPG their concerns and hopefully be able to get YPG to change some issue around dress or something like that. And I thought, wow, you know, I mean, even in the US, that's pretty radical. So yeah. I don't know what the issue was. The issue was the MacGuffin, but the very fact that these women in this council through TebDem were addressing the militia, you know, I thought was pretty unique.
Yeah, the idea they could actually bring them to the table and be like, hey, this is – hey, buddies, how's it going? Have some tea.
We have some issues.
Yeah.
And guess what? We have veto power.
Yeah.
So that gives a feel for it. And again, the hard part in the entire thing is to paint the backdrop, unless you visited there, is to paint the, you know, the landscape of this portrait, because where it's arising from, even in Kurdish culture, which is very, like I said, very secular, it is still very gender, you know, it is very male gender dominant. And so what Öcalan and PKK and, you know, TebDem are doing is really pretty radical. And, you know, I kept thinking to myself, does it ever play out into any type of, you know, negative comments, negative consequences from the male community, from the Arab community and things like that. And I asked a great deal of times, you know, as quietly as I could, you know, is there any backlash because of this? And really didn't experience any. I think, the one thing that I did notice is during the commune council that I wrote about in the second or the third dispatch, the men and the women, you know, in spite of everything, still did pretty much sit with each other or sit, you know, so the women sat together in the room and the men sat together in the room. But I noticed, and this was even from the Arab attendees of that meeting, there was no discomfort in that room. You know, there was no shifting. There was no, you know, kind of like nervous coughing or things like that. It was very comfortable, and people were definitely okay with it. And you know, women don't come through the rooms where men sit shaking hands, and that's exactly what happened the very, you know, as the meeting was beginning to convene. So even small little etiquettes like that I saw indicate to me that not only is this a very important road, but it's one that we should probably, as anarchists, take a look at and start thinking seriously about what does this imply for, you know, down the road, what we maybe want to do, or how do we address kind of issues of gender and that type of thing. So just, you know, it's not that it's our solution, but it's like, wow, I never really thought about, you know, I think that it's a completely different situation in the US, but nonetheless, it's something to write about, to think about, to cogitate about.
So I think, like, it goes back to you talking about wanting to be a tabula rasa and having, like, open eyes going into a situation. And even if you see a situation and you can't compare it to where you're from and you only have limited information, that's like a starting point for thinking and taking stuff home and being like, I don't have to reproduce this, but what are the implications? What are the impacts? What would it take to have that similar feeling here?
And kind of the bigger, the meta lesson from the entire thing is that you think about the huge assumptions that are made in the West, you know, assumptions of private property, work, what a day looks like. I mean, things that we wake up with and are just basically stamped onto us because we hear it, we see it, we feel it, we touch it, we taste it every day. It comes to us from, you know, all sorts of different sources. That's the same type of thing that they've experienced with, you know, gender in you know, the Middle East. And yet here are people directly working against that, right? So it's like all of this indoctrination that we face on a day-to-day basis, you know, all of this false consciousness that just falls out of the sky on us, it's possible to do something about. You know, it's not something that's hopeless. It's not something that we'll never be able to shake ourselves off of. It may take generations, but to be able to begin the process, I think, is real important. So that's another piece of the hope, is that, wow, you take a look at how truly blind and indoctrinated and into the matrix so many people are, and you think it would be impossible to bring a society out of it, or even to bring myself out of it. And yet here's an example of people who are doing just that.
F*** you, Fukuyama, and a history, shove that.
Cool. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
You're listening to WSFM LP 103.3 in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw. I'm William Goodenough.
And I'm Bruce Goodness.
This program is brought to you by Firestorm Books and Coffee, located at 610 Haywood Road. Firestorm Books and Coffee is a worker-owned cooperative in Asheville specializing in offbeat, underground, and independent literature. Firestorm's full catalog of books and zines can be found online at firestorm.coop.
You've been listening to part two of three of Burst's conversation with Paul Z. Simons, a.k.a. El Errante, about his stay in the northern regions of Syria, also known as Rojava. Rojava is three cantons under the direction of the Tevdem, or Movement for a Democratic Society, attempting to implement the administration of a multi-ethnic feminist, ecological, anti-capitalist, and stateless alternative in Rojava. Stay tuned for the exciting conclusion in coming weeks, or check out our blog for parts 1, 2, and 3.